You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Hollywood 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine, and if time allows, also from the March 2018 issue. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of 2001, A Film Odyssey by Bruce Handy. Shooting finally began on December 29, 1965, with the sequence set on the moon, where Floyd and other scientists first encounter the black rectangular slab, eerily prefiguring a giant iPhone, which Kubrick had finally settled on for the shape of his alien artifact, after toying with translucent cubes and tetrahedrons. By March, the production had moved on to its most elaborate set of all, the Discovery's work and living area, a centrifuge that rotated to simulate gravity. Kubrick's production team had taken 6 months to build an actual centrifuge with a diameter of 40 feet and a weight of 40 tons. Dressed for its entire 360 degrees, the set could turn forward or backward at a top rate of 3 miles an hour, creaking and groaning as it got up to speed. For some scenes, the actors had to be strapped in place by hidden harnesses as they spun upside down, with props such as meal trays and video pads glued or bolted in place. Depending on the shot, the set's entire circumference might be aglow with lights, the actors locked inside and forced to turn on the camera themselves before hitting their marks. In production photos, the set resembles a demented and unlikely torture device, a hybrid of jewelry tumbler and blistering heat lamp. With God knows how many megawatts surging through the entire setup, lights frequently exploded, while unsecured props and overlooked pieces of equipment plummeted as they reached the top of the arc, narrowly missing actors and crew members. A portentous spectacle, accompanied by terrifying noises and popping light bulbs, as Clark described it. Even at this late date, major plot points remained unresolved. Kubrick and Clark were still trying to figure out how Hal would get wind of Bowman and Poole's plan to disconnect him, when Lockwood suggested that the computer read the astronaut's lips. To voice Hal, Kubrick had originally hired Martin Balsam, but decided he sounded too distinctly American. An English actor had been rejected for parallel reasons. Kubrick eventually split the American-British difference and used a Canadian actor, Douglas Rain. Another sticking point in the script was Hal Bowman having ventured out in his space pod without his helmet in a futile effort to rescue Poole, would get back into the main ship when Hal refuses Bowman's order to open the pod bay doors. After calling in reams of research on how long a helmetless human might survive in deep space, in other words, the effect on the chimpanzee of rapid decompression to a near vacuum, Kubrick pitched Clark the idea that Bowman would use an emergency escape hatch to blow himself into an open airlock. "I had thought of this gambit, and it's quite okay," Clark responded, also crawling with Freudian symbols, as you are doubtless aware. This shot, with the astronaut hurtling toward the camera, then bouncing back and forth until he manages to grab onto a handle that allows oxygen into the chamber, proved somewhat harrowing for Gillet, who, with no helmet to hide behind, had to forego a stunt double. Though seemingly horizontal, the scene was filmed with the camera at the bottom of the airlock set, looking up. delay, perched on a hidden platform 2 stories above, had to dive headfirst through the escape hatch, secured by a hidden rope attached to a harness underneath his costume. As the actor fell, the rope sped through the gloved hands of a circus roustabout. It was only the roustabout's grip and a carefully measured knot that kept Delay from smashing into the camera. I think that was the only time on 2001 I got something on the first take, the actor said. Thank God. I asked if there had been a fail-safe in case the knot slipped through the roustabout's hands. I would have been dead, Delay replied, not sounding too concerned. I had been working with Stanley for months, and I totally trusted him. Nothing could go wrong if Stanley was in charge. I don't think I'm very happy now. Shooting of the Discovery scenes continued through the spring of 1966. The physical production then paused for more than a year while Kubrick figured out where and how to film the opening Dawn of Man sequence. He had first intended to go on location in Africa, then sought out landscapes in Britain that might pass for African desert, no dice, then finally settled on building sets using an experimental front projection system to create deep focus photographic vistas. The credibly simian man-ape costumes, at the director's insistence, one female was given breast that could actually expel milk, though the baby chimpanzee playing a nursing Australopithecus failed to latch on camera, were designed and manufactured amid tight security, as Kubrick feared spies from the 20th Century Fox film Planet of the Apes, then in production as well. It would be a matter of some bitterness among the 2001 crew when the far more cartoonish, though effective, makeup from Planet of the Apes won an honorary Oscar, while 2001's was ignored. Meanwhile, the art department and special effects teams, along with a crew of more than 100 model makers, were toiling on the film's intricate special effects shots. Produced by the director's demands for unprecedented realism, the effects team, led by Tom Howard, Con Peterson, Douglas Trumbull, and Wally Beavers, went to heroic lengths. Their breakthroughs well documented in 2 books by the writer Piers Bisani and in numerous film journal articles. One overriding difficulty was that Kubrick insisted there be no second or third generation degradation of the film image when shots were composited. Thus, every element of a given scene, a spaceship, say, plus a starfield, and maybe a planet, or actor, or both, had to be shot on the same film negative, with separate passes through the camera, sometimes coming more than a year apart. More complex shots might have 7, 8, even 10 elements. If a new pass was wonky, if stars showed through the edge of a spaceship, the negative would be scrapped and the entire sequence begun over. As Kubrick wrote Clark, we are getting magnificent shots, but everything is like a 106-move chess game with 2 adjournments. That letter is dated January 1, 1967, several months after the originally scheduled opening date for 2001. The relationship between Kubrick and Clark had grown tense by this point, since delays on the film and the ongoing evolution of its plot had also pushed back publication of the novel, the profits from which Clark claimed he was in quite desperate need of. Kubrick had arranged a bank loan for Clark, but Clark was not mollified. Citing his agents' and publishers' warnings that delaying the book would substantially diminish its earnings, he wrote Kubrick, "You can afford to take that risk. I can't. And surely you will agree that if you are wrong, and we do lose $100,000 or so between us, you will at least be under a moral obligation to me." Kubrick's irritated reply to a subsequent plea while offering to lend Clark another $15,000 himself. As you can imagine, there is a considerable amount of money involved in the film, too, and as many good reasons for people wanting it finished. The only difference has been that instead of continual pressure and oblique recriminations, there has been an objective understanding of the problem, something that would be greatly appreciated regarding the novel. It was eventually published, quite successfully, several months after the film's release. Perhaps Kubrick's intent all along, not wanting the book to step on the picture. MGM was considerably more patient with Kubrick than Clark had been, even as the film's budget began to inflate. In the fall of 1966, Variety reported that 2001's cost had crept up from just over $6 million to $7 million. Robert O'Brien remained sanguine. "Stanley is an honest fellow," he told Variety, explaining that Kubrick had been upfront about cost overruns. "Now, for $6 million, we could have had a Buck Rogers sort of thing, but why have Buck Rogers at $6 million when you can have Stanley Kubrick at $7 million? Kubrick, who had chosen to film in England, in part to keep MGM at a very long arm's length, he would soon relocate there personally, didn't always repay O'Brien's indulgence. In response to the studio's request for 2.5 minutes of sizzle reel footage to show at a theater owner's convention, the director groused, "Everything like this now becomes a nuisance and a time-consuming thing, keeping me from getting the picture done. I don't think I'm very happy now about trying to select 2.5 minutes. Around the same time that O'Brien was reassuring Variety all was well with his space epic, he and several other executives flew over to England to make certain. According to Andrew Birkin, who along with Ivor Powell was responsible for maintaining the meticulous charts that tracked all the special effects work, on a particular day, Stanley called us in and said, "Gee, fellas," this was his catchphrase, "Gee, fellas, Metro is sending over the guys next Saturday," because by then they were getting very concerned that the completion date was forever being extended. So Stanley said, "Can you get together some charts that look impressive and stick them up around the conference room? Don't worry, they don't have to mean anything, they just have to look good. We just made whatever came into our heads." At some point, I got called into the conference room, and Stanley said, "Oh, this is Andrew," and then, "Andrew, could you please explain these charts?" I just had to wing it, sort of bluffed, and they were suitably impressed and went off and wrote another check. And so the film continued. So good luck, man. Special effects work, editing, and other post-production labors continued right up to the April 1968 premiere in Washington, D.C., with Kubrick setting himself up with an editing bay on the Queen Elizabeth as he recrossed the Atlantic by sea. In the end, he forewent depicting aliens, figuring any life form that human beings could design would not be otherworldly enough by definition. Clark had come up with the idea of Bowman turning into a fetus-like star child at the end of the film. Whether that image was meant literally or metaphorically is your call. But Kubrick's archive includes a cable to a Chicago biological supplies company requesting preserved human embryos in various stages of development, presumably a product of Kubrick's need to research any concept to the nth degree. The company replied in a terse cable that it was unable to supply human embryos. Sorry. It might sound funny to say this about a glacially paced 2-hour and 19-minute movie that some people find crushingly dull, but in the editing room, Kubrick pared away ruthlessly at 2001, the storytelling growing ever more elliptical. What he was after, he later said, was a nonverbal statement. Gone now was the heavy-handed narration. Gone, too, were chunks of expository dialogue, including an entire scene in which, following Hal's death, Mission Control explains what went wrong with the computer. Faced with a conflict in his programming, he developed, for want of a better description, neurotic symptoms. The last of the film's elements to fall into place was its soundtrack. Kubrick had hired the composer Alex North, with whom he had worked on Spartacus, 1960, to score 2001. Beginning in December 1967, North was put up in an apartment in London, where, without being allowed to see much of the still-evolving film, he wrote his score and ultimately recorded upwards of 40 minutes' worth of music. But the director was fond of the classical and modern orchestral music he had been using as temporary tracks, pieces by Johann Strauss II, Richard Strauss, Gyorgy Ligeti, and Aram Khachaturian. Kubrick warned North he might end up using the temp pieces, but waffled as North continued working on the first part of his score. Flummoxed by Kubrick's indecision and a tight deadline, the composer began suffering from back spasms so severe he couldn't conduct and had to be taken to recording sessions in an ambulance. In notes to himself, now in the collection of the Margaret Herrick Library at the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, he seemed to vent his frustration. Delaying me. Liked stuff, then changed his mind. Psychological hang-up. At the end of January, Kubrick informed North that his services were no longer needed. "I'm really sorry it all had to end this way, without some discussion in connection with the music I had written," North wrote Kubrick, somewhat bitterly. But like so many spent collaborators, he could still summon admiration, ending his letter on an upbeat note. Ellipses are North's in this sentence. "All the best to you on the film. What I saw is pretty sensational. So, good luck, man." A very special sort of boring fascination. There is a Hollywood legend that 2001 was initially a big bust, dismissed by critics, ignored by ticket buyers, and on the verge of being yanked out of theaters when it was at last discovered and embraced by a lot of young people smoking funny cigarettes, as Keir Dulay put it. There is a kernel of truth in that, but only just. As Dulay recalled the preview screenings, people walked out wondering, what is this meaningless bullshit? Early reviews trended toward mixed to negative. In the New York Times, Renata Adler wrote that 2001 exerts a very special sort of boring fascination. But the film was a hit with young audiences right off the bat. Variety reported that initial ticket sales were 30% ahead of numbers for David Lean's Dr. Zhivago, 1965, MGM's biggest hit of the decade to that point. Kubrick's picture won an Oscar for special effects, awarded solely to him under rules then in place, and received nominations for direction, original screenplay, and art direction. Best Director was an honor Kubrick would never receive, inexplicably, despite 4 nominations across the course of his career. He had been confident enough in his work on 2001 that, shortly before its release, he had bought $20,500 worth of MGM stock in the belief his film would goose the studio's profits. It did. But O'Brien couldn't survive a shareholder revolt, and in 1969, the company fell into the hands of financier Kurt Kerkorian, who sold off the studio's most valuable assets, including rights to its glorious library of films, such as Gone with the Wind and Singin' in the Rain, and left behind a corporate husk. Still, the early bad reviews continued to irk Kubrick. New York was really the only hostile city, he told Playboy later that year, still touchy months after the fact. Perhaps there was a certain element of the lumpen literati that is so dogmatically atheist and materialist and earthbound that it finds the grandeur of space and the myriad mysteries of cosmic intelligentsia anathema. I did hear through the grapevine that he was pretty disappointed by the film's initial reviews, Ivor Powell said, which Andrew Birkin, who continued working with Kubrick on an aborted Napoleon movie, seconded. I think, like most geniuses, he had an innate confidence in his own brilliance, but at the same time, you want to be appreciated by others. He showed me a lot of letters from children that he'd received, which I think gave him more pleasure than anything else, that children seemed to grasp something from the movie that went beyond a straightforward storyline. As it happens, I know all about that, if you will indulge me in a personal note. I was 10 when I saw 2001, a year or so into its initial release. I had no idea what to make of it, really, beyond that the lonely, empty distances of space travel seemed creepy and sad. The monolith was both seductive and forbidding. And the finale, with the pounding timpani of Richard Strauss's Also Sprach Zarathustra, behind the image of the wide-eyed planet-sized star child, had terrified me. What it meant, who knew? But the picture had taken me somewhere, and I felt a need to continue grappling with it. I read the novel. I listened to the soundtrack album, the first LP I ever bought. I was an odd kid. I couldn't have articulated it like this at the time, but movies, I now understood, could be more than just Disney-style fun. I was hooked by something. By cinema. There, I said it. Which has proved to be a lifelong reward. And here I am, still grappling with 2001 A Space Odyssey. A real-life moon base would have been cool. But passion is more than consolation. How to Make a Minion. This Vanity Fair spotlight is by Bruce Handy. And in the photos, character designs by Illumination Animation Studios' Eric Keon, illustrating the evolution of the Minions, who were created in collaboration with Despicable Me directors Pierre Coffin and Chris Renault. The Flying Monkeys never got their own movie, nor did the Imperial Stormtroopers, nor did Rosa Klebb, Odd Job, or Jaws. The Moonraker sidekick, not the shark. You know who did get their own movie? The Minions, which by Hollywood law makes them the greatest movie henchmen of all time. Certainly the funniest and most often mimicked, as parents of young children will tell you. The Minions are themselves toddler-esque in their enthusiasms. Simpsons, yellow and shaped like stunted oxygen tanks, they speak a kind of high-speed pigeon gibberish, in which crowd-pleasing words such as banana and poop occasionally emerge whole. They first appeared in Despicable Me, 2010, an animated film which they stole from their evil master, the not-all-that-villainous Steve Carell-voiced Gru. This was followed by Despicable Me 2 and 3, also stolen, and the aforementioned Minions, 2015, an origin story. But here is their real origin story, an exclusive peek at their fossil history. The team that created the Minions for Despicable Me consisted of character designer Eric Keon and directors Pierre Coffin and Chris Renaud. 1. Here we see the original conception of the Minions as short human factory workers, designed, their creators say, mainly to contrast with the much taller Gru. 2. As the film's look and story evolved, human workers morphed into robots. The idea was that robots would be more credibly naive, as well as more amusingly knocked around. The single eyes are meant to convey a dimming of wits. 3. Eventually, the filmmakers settled on a kind of robot-human synthesis, or if not human, at least something more or less organic, melding the innocence of the former with the relatability of the latter. 4-6. A brief experiment with red pigmentation, followed by increasing simplification of form, brought the Minions closer to the unique, not quite organic, not quite manufactured, but wide-eyed and wholly childlike, whatever it is they ours, we know and love today. And 7. The first sketch of a Minion in final form, with arms to the side. Note how the shrinking overalls now also suggest a diaper or underwear. This is called knowing your audience. The Road to Bally High. Even for the fabled songwriting team of Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein, crafting a Broadway musical from James Michener's Pulitzer Prize-winning 1947 novel with its frank treatment of racial prejudice was a challenge. In an adaptation from his book on the pioneering duo, Todd S. Purdom describes what made South Pacific the Hamilton of its day with a Pulitzer of its own. Opening photo, Gonna Wash That Man, Mary Martin and cast members in 1949. And Nothing Like a Dame, an audition for South Pacific with rehearsal pianist Jack Prenner. This article is adapted from Something Wonderful, Rodgers and Hammerstein's Broadway Revolution by Todd S. Purdom, to be published in April by Henry Holt and Company. Copyright 2018 by Todd S. Purdom. All rights reserved. "Those fellows are so mad," James Michener would remember, thinking about Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein II. "They could make a great musical out of 3 pages of the Bronx telephone directory." Rodgers and Hammerstein, the most successful songwriting team on Broadway, were angry because they just had their first flop, Allegro. What they had in front of them now was Michener's first book, Tales of the South Pacific, was a neither fish nor fowl creation. Not a standard novel with a beginning, middle, and end, but rather an accumulation of atmospheric character sketches. The New York Times had pronounced it truly one of the most remarkable books to come out of World War II, and its appeal lay in its granularity, in its depiction of American types interacting with South Sea Island originals, more than in its inherent drama. Michener's wartime service in the Pacific had left him with a notebook full of vivid impressions and memorable characters, but Oscar Hammerstein would somehow have to distill it all into a coherent libretto that could hold an audience for 2.5 hours. There was no shortage of color. "I wish I could tell you about the South Pacific," Michener's book begins, in an evocative passage that Oscar underlined in his personal copy. "The way it actually was, the endless ocean, the infinite specks of coral we called islands, coconut palms nodding gracefully toward the ocean, reefs upon which waves broke into spray, and inner lagoons lovely beyond description. I wish I could tell you about the sweating jungle, the full moon rising behind the volcanoes, and the waiting, the timeless, repetitive waiting. But whenever I start to talk about the South Pacific, people intervene. I try to tell somebody what the steaming Hebrides were like, and first thing you know, I'm telling about the old Tonkinese woman who used to sell human heads as souvenirs for $50. Indeed, it is just such a woman, Bloody Mary, a wily betel nut chewing entrepreneur and master of pidgin GI slang, who features prominently in Fodala, the longest story in the book. Making the acquaintance of handsome young Lieutenant Joe Cable, she spirits him to the nearby island of Bally High, where the French planters have sequestered their daughters for the war, and where he promptly falls for Mary's own lovely daughter, Liette. With Mary playing an uncomfortable combination of matchmaker and procurer, Cable is drawn again and again to the Mystic Island. But despite his deep love for the girl, he knows he can never marry her or take her home to his family in Philadelphia. Bloody Mary's response as Cable heads off to duty in Operation Alligator, a major assault on a Japanese-held island, is unsparing. "Lieutenant, one bullshit goddamn fool!" Michener summons up a gallery of other compelling characters. There is Tony Fry, a swashbuckling American officer with a penchant for acting outside the regular chain of command. He figures in The Cave, one of the most dramatic stories in the collection, about a group of soldiers stationed on a small island who are trying to keep the Japanese from retaking Guadalcanal. There is Lieutenant Buss Adams, an American bomber pilot who was shot down and whose rescue mission cost the American taxpayers $600,000. But it's worth every cent of the money, Michener's narrator notes, if you happen to be that pilot. There is Luther Billis, a tanned, tattooed CB from the Navy's construction battalion, who is obsessed with a ritual ceremony on a neighboring island involving a native boar's tooth. There is Ensign Bill Harbison, a snappy, ambitious, married officer from Albuquerque, who takes a shine to a Navy nurse from Arkansas. Nellie Forbush loses his head and tries to rape her. And finally, there is Emile Debec, a middle-aged French plantation owner who falls in love with Forbush and asks her to marry him in a story called Our Heroine. Nellie agrees, until she learns that Debec has 8 mixed-race daughters with 4 different mothers, 2 Javanese, 1 Tonkinese, and 1 Polynesian. But in the end, Nellie overcomes her fears and prejudices, returns to Emile, and joins his daughters in singing Au Clair de la Lune. It was a lot for a librettist to absorb, and with his usual meticulous attention to detail and his strong eye for plot and character, Hammerstein went through Michener's book, story by story, underlining bits of dialogue, making red grease pencil check marks in the margins, suggesting at one point that Cable, who in the book never meets Nellie Forbush, could have a scene telling her all about Bloody Mary's improbable proposal. On a sheet of yellow legal paper, with page numbers from Michener's book running down the left margin, he made notes of the characters' names. Hammerstein's work gained added impetus, and the whole project got a big shot in the arm on April 27, 1948, with the surprise news that Tales of the South Pacific had won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction. For Hammerstein, part of the strong appeal of Michener's book was its frank treatment of racial prejudice, which was anything but a theoretical issue for his own family. Rodgers and Hammerstein had already reinvented the Broadway musical with their pioneering Oklahoma and Carousel, which integrated dance, story, and song as never before in the service of realistic drama. Now they were dealing head-on with a ripped-from-the-headlines subject that confronted the social changes and tensions sweeping America. Oscar's wife, Dorothy, had a sister named Eleanor, nicknamed Duty, who was married to Jerry Watanabe, the son of a British woman whose father had once been an ambassador to Japan, and a Japanese man who was a director of the industrial trading from Mitsui and Company. Jerry had been raised to be the very model of a proper Englishman, educated at Cambridge, and was a fine tennis player and golfer. When the United States entered World War II in 1941, he was working in the New York offices of Mitsui and, as a Japanese national, was interned at Ellis Island. Even after he was released, he could not find work, so Dorothy hired him to manage the accounts of her interior decorating business. During Jerry's internment, Duty and their daughter, Jennifer, lived for a time with the Hammersteins at their farm in Doylestown, Pennsylvania. And when Dorothy and her sister took the girl to be enrolled at the local school, they asked the principal for assurances that she would not face discrimination. "She'll have to pay the price for her antecedents," the man answered. And Jennifer went instead to a local Quaker school and then to the George School in Newtown, Pennsylvania, which the Hammersteins' son Jimmy also attended, along with a young family friend named Stephen Sondheim. Next photo, Happy Talk. Martin as Nellie Forbush and posing with cast members, 1949. Hammerstein made a particular point of combating prejudice. He had volunteered his time for the Writers' War Board, a privately organized group that worked in close coordination with a raft of government agencies to promote the Allied cause and combat racism and anti-Semitism on the home front. Hammerstein had never been one who could say no to what he saw as a good cause, and was one of the entertainment world's most stalwart liberal voices. Among his other pursuits, working to end segregation in baseball. In 1949, Oscar and Dorothy Hammerstein joined James Michener and another Pennsylvania neighbor, the author Pearl S. Buck, in helping to create Welcome House, the country's first interracial international adoption agency, begun with the particular mission of placing Amerasian children, many of them the offspring of broken wartime romances, in American homes. For their part, Dick Rogers and his wife, also named Dorothy, were well aware that no amount of artistic success could enable them or their two teenage daughters to crack the elite social clubs, resorts, and cotillions that barred Jews from membership. South Pacific would be a not-so-quiet statement of protest, but it's hard to remember just how forward-leaning the subject matter was in any context at the time, much less as the spine of a Broadway musical. Segregation was still a fact of life not only in the Jim Crow South, but in much of the urban North as well. It had been only 2 years earlier that Jackie Robinson broke minor league baseball's color line. In the draft of the South Pacific script that Hammerstein and Joshua Logan, the show's director and co-author, completed in time for the first cast rehearsal, there is a bit of dialogue that would be dropped before the first performance. After Nellie has broken off her relationship with Emil in horror at his mixed-race children, and Cable finds himself unable to marry Liat, despite his love for her, the young Americans share their feelings. "Damn it to hell," Cable shouts to Nellie. "Why? Why do you look so damned shocked? What's the difference if her hair is blonde and curly, or black and straight? If I want her to be my wife, why can't I have her?" "You can," Nellie replies. "It's just that people, they say it never works, don't they?" "They do," Cable answers in disgust. "And then everybody does their damnedest to prove it. A hell of a chance Liat and I would have in one of those little gray stone and timber houses on the main line. Mr. and Mrs. Joseph Cable entertained last Tuesday with a housewarming. Nobody came." The dialogue may have sounded too raw to survive, but the song that followed it remained in place. The song Cable sings in response to Nellie's assertion that her prejudice is something that is born in me, and Emil's insistence that it cannot have been. Indeed, Joe explains, it happens after you're born. You've got to be taught to hate and fear. You've got to be taught from year to year. It's got to be drummed in your dear little ear. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught to be afraid of people whose eyes are oddly made, and people whose skin is a different shade. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught before it's too late, before you were 6 or 7 or 8, to hate all the people your relatives hate. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be carefully taught. In Oscar's original draft, Emil, who was played by the great opera basso Ezio Pinza, continues the song, declaring, "Love is quite different. It grows by itself." And then singing, "It will grow like a weed on a mountain of stones. You don't have to feed or put fat on its bones. It can live on a smile or a note of a song." It may starve for a while, but it stumbles along. Stumbles along with its banner unfurled, the joy and the beauty, the hope of the world. Rogers rejected the last verses as unnecessary, but stood in lockstep behind the song. The New Haven opening was set for Monday, March 7th, 1949. From Williams College, where he was an undergraduate, Stephen Sondheim sent a cheeky telegram of congratulations asking, "Do you need a good baritone?" But Josh Logan, whose emotions could veer wildly from exultation to despair, was on edge. On Hotel Taft stationery, he scrawled a note to Hammerstein, "Thank you for the show and the fine time I had working with you and the credit sharing and all the boost and gooses," he wrote. "For God's sake, don't let's make two quick decisions tomorrow night." Referring to the group of lawyers, investors, agents, and other kibitzers who were in town for the opening, he went on, "I will fix anything," underlined twice in this show, "toward the happiness of all three of us, but I cannot give full satisfaction to all the other would-be critics." As if validating his qualms, Logan watched that evening's performance with growing trepidation. First, the star Mary Martin's big comic number, "I'm Gonna Wash That Man Right Out of My Hair," which he'd felt sure would be a smash, landed with a fizzle. Then "A Wonderful Guy," sung by Nellie and a bunch of nurses, also seemed to fall flat. Next photos, enchanted evenings. Martin and Ezio Pinza, the majestic theater in Manhattan, where South Pacific opened in April 1949. Richard Rogers and Oscar Hammerstein in New York City, 1949. The next night, when "Wash That Man" and "Wonderful Guy" produced the same underwhelming reaction, Logan was again puzzled, until his friend Molly Williams, whose actor-playwright husband Emlyn had come to New Haven to help trim the show's running time, confessed that she had not heard "Wash That Man" at all because the audience was all abuzz, talking to one another, and wondering whether Martin was really washing her hair. She was, 8 times a week. Logan's solution was easy. Have Mary sing one full chorus of the song to put over the lyrics, and then get out the shampoo. It took him about 10 days with the show in Boston to solve the riddle of "Wonderful Guy." He thought the problem might be that Nellie was confessing her innermost thoughts to her fellow nurses, spoiling an intimate moment. "Too bad the song can't be a soliloquy," Logan mused to Hammerstein, who promptly agreed, and switched the pronouns in the song from "you" to "they." That night she tore the house apart, Logan would recall. There were a few other changes. On March 9th, Hammerstein's old friend Essie Robison, the wife of Paul Robison, wrote to wonder why Archie Savage, the sole black dancer in the show, and a spectacular one at that, was always jitterbugging. "It is very possible that I am unduly sensitive racially, but so are a lot of us, and it would help enormously that if just once he appeared with his comrades not cutting up." Oscar immediately replied to Robeson, "Since you have seen the play, and before I received your letter, we have inserted an episode in which Archie Savage is not jitterbugging." Hammerstein was less sympathetic to Lieutenant Commander Thomas McWhorter of the Navy, who fired off an early broadside against the song "You've Got to Be Carefully Taught," asking that it be cut. "It is like drinking a scotch and soda and suddenly swallowing the ice cube," McWhorter wrote. "You could not have interrupted the beautiful flow of entertainment any more effectively had you stopped the show for a VD lecture." Oscar wrote back, "I believe I got the point of your letter very clearly, and I realize very well the dangers of overstating the case. but I just feel that the case is not fully stated without this song. I wish it were true that all these things are accepted by the public. You say the theme is wearing very thin, but in spite of this, I see progress being made only very slowly. The show opened in Boston on Tuesday, March 15th, and Rodgers and Hammerstein could have written the reviews themselves. Don Fellows, a young member of the cast, would recall knowing that the company had something special in hand when ticketless theatergoers outside the Schubert began offering cast members $100 for a pair. The New York opening was set for Thursday, April 7th, 1949. Hammerstein and Rodgers were confident enough of the critics' verdict that they abandoned theatrical superstition and booked their own opening night party, an elegant supper dance at the St. Regis roof, and ordered a couple of hundred copies of the New York Times to pass out to their guest. They had not miscalculated. The critics offered raves all around. Brooks Atkinson in the Times called the play a magnificent musical drama. Richard Watts Jr. of the New York Post found the show an utterly captivating work of theatrical art. And Howard Barnes of the New York Herald Tribune pronounced it a show of rare enchantment. Predictably, Carefully Taught came in for its share of criticism, with John Mason Brown of Saturday Review complaining that it smacked of dragged-in didacticism, while the New Yorker found it just a little embarrassing. But Rodgers and Hammerstein's theatrical peers and colleagues were ecstatic. In a note to Oscar and Dorothy Hammerstein, Helen Hayes wrote, "Words won't do it. Flowers failed to say it. There's just no way to express the gratitude I felt for last Thursday night and for the many other wonderful times you've given me with your talent. I'm just humbly thankful to be living in the same period with you. South Pacific tops everything you've ever done." This article, which is the last article in the Hollywood 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine, will be continued in the next installment, and then we will be moving on to the March 2018 issue. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.